my fellow plebs, River is setting a new standard in Bitcoin. At river.com, you'll pay zero fees when you dollar cost average. Truly the best way to build your Bitcoin wealth. All Bitcoin at River is held in secure cold storage with 100% full reserves. There's no need to wonder what's happening behind the scenes. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. Additionally, River lets you make Bitcoin payments via the Lightning Network, offers a Lightning integration for developers, and allows you to mine Bitcoin directly to your River account. River has a level of service that is unheard of in this industry, including phone support, private client advisors, and the ability to designate beneficiaries to inherit your Bitcoin wealth. River has become the premium name in Bitcoin that anyone can easily access. Sure, you have a place to buy Bitcoin, but have you tried River? See and feel the difference at river.com and the River iOS app, the preferred partner of Bitcoin Magazine.
What's up, Mark? How's it going? Good morning.
Good morning, Chris. What is up, everybody? Thanks for joining us here. Have some little coffee, talk a little Bitcoin history. Appreciate everyone being here. We'll let everyone filter in. We'll get going. We will be talking some Bitcoin, WikiLeaks, Assange history. We got a little anniversary today on the 14th of June, marking the 12th year since WikiLeaks began accepting donations using Bitcoin. So we'll kind of get into some of that. I got some quotes and some things about Assange talking about using Bitcoin as, you know, more than just a financial tool. So we got some interesting quotes on that as like a time stamping tool. I think it'll be pretty fun. And we'll get into all that shit. And then hopefully just open it up and let people riff about Assange and the magazine and a bunch of other stuff. Yeah, let's start talking about shit. So obviously we just did the Gatekeepers issue, which was a, you know, our one sort of spring release that was a print editorial that featured Assange on the cover. And then we had a lot of awesome contributions and pieces and things kind of around Assange, around WikiLeaks, and talking about gatekeeping just in general. And then how Bitcoin is a tool that can be used to sort of circumnavigate the gatekeepers of the day, if you will. But we decided to have a little spaces today because it is the 12-year anniversary of WikiLeaks, you know, first publicly posting a Bitcoin address, first talking about, you know, using Bitcoin basically as a way to circumnavigate, again, to use that word because it's just so fun, financial censorship. That they were dealing with, you know, due to sort of these gatekeepers of the financial and payment system. So yeah, basically in 2011, WikiLeaks was struck with some sanctions where their accounts were getting frozen. So Visa, MasterCard, Bank of America, PayPal, the banking arm of the Swiss Postal Service, Post Finance, all froze or seized or prevented future WikiLeaks associated funds from getting to the people that, you know, needed these funds to, you know, continue to do their publication and their work. You know, kind of around the same time, I believe it was earlier on in that month. Yeah, it was. It was June of 2011. There were multiple senators that had come up, including Chuck Schumer, that came out and called for the shutdown of the Silk Road. So basically, you know, that was kind of the start of the then they fight you phase, if you really want to go all the way back. And it's so wild also to look at the history of it, because it's kind of before Bitcoin was really, had even really monetized in any significant way. And in fact, actually, Satoshi himself had made reference to like, hey, please don't do this. We're not ready for this yet. Kind of infamously referencing the kicking the hornet's nest, and that this would bring too much attention on the global scale and too much attention from the gatekeepers of the state against, you know, the publication and sort of information, I don't know, innovations that WikiLeaks was doing, both in the way that they distributed information and at kind of the scale and the type of information that they were distributing. So right around at this exact same time, yeah, we're beginning to see kind of the first war on Bitcoin. And, you know, that has not stopped, really. It's definitely changed. It's modulated throughout the years. You know, we had kind of the another use case similarly. This was not directly against Bitcoin, but of course we had like the trucker convoy movement a year and a half ago or so, which ended up using Bitcoin to circumnavigate other financial, you know, censorship. But yeah, it's a really interesting time, I think, to go back and look at some of this, yeah, this history of Bitcoin to sort of see what kind of things, you know, the cypherpunks and the cryptographers of that day were sort of talking about. And I think when you kind of begin to look at some of the things that Assange was saying about Bitcoin at that time, he really understood a lot of what was coming in the development and the future of Bitcoin. And obviously, you know, kind of understood that there would perhaps be an appreciation involved, which I think is very fascinating, that because of, you know, basically the way that they were forced to use Bitcoin, they were sort of forced to speculate and hold and ended up seeing pretty significant appreciation in their kind of war chest. So I think Assange definitely saw the economic value of of Bitcoin as a way to help WikiLeaks very early on. But he also kind of understood a lot more about it in terms of, you know, kind of what it actually is, what the technology is actually doing, and how you can use that same censorship resistant database to be basically a time stamping tool, and how important that is, you know, as him kind of going through the motions and figuring out kind of how to be, you know, a publisher. And that was sort of what WikiLeaks had kind of developed into. And that was a role that he, you know, very much so took with pride. You know, he referenced himself as a publisher. I think he really understood that that crux of information is that so much of it is, yes, writing, yes, journalism, yes, articulation, but also just the literal publishing of it is essential, and how you do it and what the mechanisms of that is, and how that helps the information be distributed and actually stand up in an adversarial environment. I think one of the pieces that will be pinned up here to the top, hopefully, it's the first tweet, is Assange. He wrote this piece in 2006 called Conspiracy as Governance. And I think it really sets the stage very nicely. I highly recommend reading it. You don't necessarily have to do it right now, but some point today or you know, this week, this weekend. And it really sets the sort of the intensity of the scope of what Assange kind of realized what the world had become, and how, you know, from a logical standpoint, he's a very logical person, you know, how to actually, you know, attack and dismember basically, you know, this conspiracy, whether it's incentive structures or just direct coalition, you know, how can we actually logically attack and carve back some of the freedoms that this basically conspiracy has kind of taken away from the human race. It's an incredibly fascinating piece. Highly recommend checking it out. And I think it will really help set sort of the way that Assange looked at the world as a very adversarial environment, because it truly is, certainly was, and still is. And so I pulled up some quotes that I think are pretty fascinating that talk about a lot of the things. These are a couple of years after, you know, the 12-year anniversary we're celebrating today. But in September 2014, Assange appeared via the Ecuadorian embassy in hologram form to do an interview. And he was asked about Bitcoin and kind of two kind of main questions about Bitcoin. And I think his answers are pretty incredible, especially how ahead of their time they were, and knowing that these are things that he had kind of put into practice, you know, 3 years before. And now, you know, from this date of this interview in 2014 and now 12 years later. So I was going to go ahead and read some of these quotes about Assange talking about Bitcoin. I think they're, yeah, really, really fascinating. And it really shows kind of the depth at which he's really looking at this technology. Probably taking a couple minutes to read these. We'll get through them, and then we'll kind of open things up and talk about, you know, how do we put these things into practice and all that. But I think they're really, really fascinating, and we can get a lot of history right from his mouth rather than my, you know, early morning rantings here. All right. So the question I asked was, tell me about the benefits that come with the online banking, the virtualization, the digitization of the social function of banking. Kind of a strange question, big question, but this is Asanja's take on that. If you abstract away and you think, what is the problem with just having one bank in one town? It's pretty obvious your market size is extremely small. And to put this in sort of continental terms, the problem is that you don't have bargaining powers for people in the town. They don't have bargaining powers because they have to deal with that one bank. And if it has problems, then you can't really escape those problems. As well, it can engage in so-called rent seeking on the people who are in that town. So when you have a globalized market to differing degrees, which we're entering now in banking, people are able to have greater bargaining power in relation to banks. And thus, this keeps banks more honest in relation to their conduct with individuals. We think, of course, if you have a globalized market and something else happens where all your banks pull together and end up as one bank, then you're in a far positive worse position. But right now, the most interesting thing happening is Bitcoin. And it's probably the most interesting intellectual development on the internet in the last 5 years. So this is me talking to kind of go into that. This bargaining problem, the axioms of the bargaining problem, are something that I've personally am very interested in, coming kind of from the Princeton School of Game Theory. These axioms of the bargaining problem were first presented by John Nash in the early 50s, mid 50s. So basically he's saying, you know, when you globalize the banking network in a way that actually has decentralized control, you're giving all of the individuals that are using that online digital bank significant increased bargaining power. And so you're minimizing the bands of potential negative outcomes in any bargaining situation using money as this technological tool. Really fascinating stuff. I don't think a ton of people were kind of just starting to talk about kind of the huge effects of what Bitcoin could do at this time. You know, there were definitely some people out there that understood it early on, but I think we kind of take for granted the bullishness and astute observation of how this would develop. But Asanja understood this very early on, right? So he continues on. Okay, so a lot of people have heard about Bitcoin, but they don't really understand it. So you think, okay, it's just some online currency. What's the big deal? You know, you have a PayPal account. You have your Visa card. You know, all the pros or the processing occurs online, right? Like what's the difference, you know? But Bitcoin is different because it is a currency that's cryptographically backed, multi-jurisdictional, which means that it's very hard for any one power group in any particular jurisdiction to start turning it into a rent-seeking apparatus. And the underlying technology of Bitcoin is cryptography on the one hand, and the ability for cryptography to create situations that one can defend themselves, itself, or the people who use it against even the full might of a superpower. You know, a full might of a superpower doesn't help you smash a mouse problem. A mouse problem is a mouse problem, and it's something that is connected to the existence of intelligence in the universe or basic physics. It's not something you can get at simply through overwhelming coercive power or lots of people. And the other component of Bitcoin and the other underlying basic technology is proof of publication at a particular time. We've never really had that in any way. And this is where he gets really, really into a huge part of the time stamping publishing, you know, the actualization that Bitcoin offers. And I think he really understands Bitcoin as a publisher in a way that I think a lot of people didn't understand. And we're kind of starting to see some of these use cases come out here, you know, now, you know, years later. So he goes on to continue. If you look at the great Soviet encyclopedia back in 1954, the NKVD had just gone out of favor with the death of Stalin. And so he had a page and a half entry in the encyclopedia. And it was decided to remove it and instead put in an expanded entry on the Bering Strait. And of course, to actually do that, the encyclopedia maker had to write the new entry and post it out to all the libraries that had those encyclopedias, say, tear out that page and stick this page in. And that's why I'm able to tell you this right now, because everyone noticed. But in the digital world, we can delete history extremely easily. And history, even without an attempt to delete it, starts disappearing as a result of startup companies going under or particular bits of history not becoming profitable anymore. And that notion of being able to disappear history entered into Orwell's writing. And you can look at what it is, I think, his most substantial intellectual comment, which is, he who controls the present controls the past, and he who controls the past controls the future. It's this notion that the past is an archive of a history of our civilization, as a history of development, is in fact present right now in something physically contained in the library and computer servers and human beings' heads, that history doesn't exist except its remnants that exist in the present. And so if you can get at these remnants, you can make particular inconvenient parts of history disappear and amplify others. Bitcoin's underlying technology breaks Orwell's dictum. It breaks all of Orwell's dictum by providing proof of publishing at a certain time. And that is the intellectual underpinning of that whole system and can be used for lots and lots of other things. And so that's the big expansion we're about to see in Bitcoin. It all derives from this basic premise that you can prove that a particular statement, a particular consensus, a particular contract happened at a particular time globally. And it requires a subversion of every single jurisdiction where people running Bitcoin to be able to overturn that. So he's understanding this using Bitcoin as a publishing tool in 2014. And had been using it for 3 years already in funding WikiLeaks. So the interviewer goes on to ask, am I right in understanding that you're saying that the Bitcoin architecture has applications far beyond the economic role that Bitcoin can play, and that the architecture is strengthening the life of information in the digital space, making it less vulnerable to the kind of mischief you talked about in Russia or somewhere else? And he finishes, exactly. That underlying architecture can be used for publishers, for example, so that, you know, WikiLeaks, we are starting to use Bitcoin, stuffing our cryptographic keys of stuff that we publish. So we prove that we have published stuff at a particular time by putting it in Bitcoin, in the blockchain. And then if someone were to come and try and modify that material we have published to take out particular parts, that would be detectable. It interests, and a lot of systems can be built on this. And I've spoken to you whenever you come to an international agreement between companies at a particular time, for example, if that could be documented in Bit and the types of agreements even automated, and that allows you to start building what I call a full financial stack, which is the type of like of futures and stocks and multi-party investments and so on. And you can start building on this because you can on Bitcoin. Absolutely prophetic, wild understanding and actualization of what Bitcoin, you know, really is. Like how does it actually work? And it's a database that is a timestamping tool without any centralized power or centralized clock. And it can, you know, that's sort of what the crux of the Byzantine general's problem sort of is how do you articulate truth in an adversarial environment that's immutable? And the reason why that's so powerful and it allows to back, you know, the whole financial underpinnings of Bitcoin, you know, it allows economic activity to be prohibitively expensive to censor or to stop or to reorg, basically. And that's why, obviously, of course, you know, the financial applications of Bitcoin are its most important. But the actual underpinning of how it works, it is a time stamping publishing tool. So here we are, you know, 12 years later from WikiLeaks' first foray into using Bitcoin, and kind of the first really big, anyway, public application of Bitcoin as a way to circumnavigate adversarial payment environments. And, you know, now we have a little bit of a lead there to start looking at, you know, well, he's telling us very clearly that WikiLeaks has used Bitcoin, and not just to make a bunch of money, but to literally shove bits and pieces of, you know, the some of the stories and the data and the cables and some of these things that they've published, both as a as just a way to ensure, you know, that there's a time stamped quality to the release, but also very much so that there is actually a lot of data in the Bitcoin blockchain that was published by Assange directly in regards to WikiLeaks that can be found. You know, that's, I like to say Bitcoin is a transparency technology. And in this way, you can go and look at, you know, these addresses that were posted, and you can see there's a lot of strange things stuffed in a lot of these addresses. And he's told us that he put things there. So I definitely urge people to go and look at, you know, these addresses, look at, you know, there are ways that you can quite literally search the blockchain with different explorers and different things. There's also obviously just kind of Googling other people doing the work. But there's a lot of things that WikiLeaks has stuck in Bitcoin. And kind of continuing that tradition, there was a bunch of things that Bitcoin Magazine stuck in the blockchain and in this magazine relating to a lot of these things. So I urge you to, you know, one of the reasons why we did the magazine in the way that we did is we were really hoping that it would be kind of a, you know, teach a man to fish sort of thing. So, you know, we have a lot of information in there about how to use some public keys, how to use PGP. You know, there's a really nice guide in there by Heidi, who's in the room here, about, you know, taking responsibility for your personal privacy and the things you release onto the internet, kind of in the reverse of a lot of the things we're saying. You know, that there's sort of the incidental, permanence of publishing on the internet and how you have to kind of take care of those things. So, you know, we built this magazine sort of looking at a lot of these things. It was really fun to kind of go back and look at the history of WikiLeaks and the way Assange just talked about Bitcoin. And he's really good at leaving little trails of information in a lot of the things that he talks about and a lot of his interviews, that you can kind of go back and start to piece together some of these things and start to find some of the bigger files and things and other things that he's hidden in Bitcoin. And I also think, you know, as a inspirational thing, I think it's really important for us to realize that not only are these things already in Bitcoin, but we can actually use Bitcoin as a way to, you know, to timestamp basically our counter of dissonance to this conspiracy as a governance sort of state that Assange very, you know, clearly articulated in his 2006 piece that we also published in the magazine and is pinned up here. So yeah, it's kind of a general call to action and sort of just looking at other ways that people have understood and looked at Bitcoin in the past. And I think he very clearly understands, both from his experience of circumnavigating, you know, adversarial payment environment, and then as well as the appreciation that he gained from sort of basically being forced to hold Bitcoin. You know, he obviously understands the economic values and implications, and structures are certainly the most important and groundbreaking part of Bitcoin. But within that, you know, hey, we set up this whole system. This is what it is. It's a way to, you know, distribute, you know, basically a timestamp in an adversarial environment that can't be reorged without a trusted third party. And that can be used for so many applications and so many ways to push back on, you know, this oppressive coalition that has kind of dominated us for, you know, certainly these last 12 years since, you know, the time that they first started accepting Bitcoin. You know, we shortly saw Satoshi leave the project publicly after the WikiLeaks involvement. It was relatively shortly after. So yeah, kind of a look at, you know, hey, you know, Assange and the CryptoPunks, CypherPunks, you know, were very, very hyper intelligent and very hyper aware people of both the pressures on us and also the way that cryptography and these tools can be used to push back. And so that's kind of the general purpose of the gatekeepers, is understanding that gatekeeping is both something done to you as well as something that you can do back. And cryptography sort of as a tool, you know, basically allows you to do that. It gives you that power to gatekeep the information that you want, you know, very, very, very perfectly. And that is really a state change. And when combined with the interconnectivity of the internet, you know, that develops things like Bitcoin and like encrypted messaging and PGP and a lot of these tools that, you know, now we're seeing are being actualized and needed on a global scale. So that was my kind of like little half hour sort of rant there on the history of WikiLeaks and Bitcoin. Curious if anyone is interested in coming up and talking about any of the things that we talked about. I appreciate y'all listening. I don't know if Chris or Lola have anything that they want to say. If Heidi wants to come up and join, I got an excited bunch of hands coming up in the audience.
No, I think that was really well done, Mark. Maybe I'll pull up people as they want to come up to talk about this. But yeah, no, I think that was well said.
Awesome. Very cool. We could talk, Lola, we could talk about your piece if you're interested in getting into, I think, a phenomenal piece, one that has definitely influenced the way that I talk when in regards to, you know, how I frame the U.S. government. Don't know if you have anything you wanted to touch on there in regards to your piece.
Thank you, Miami, for the last 3 years in this amazing city. The whole world shut down, but Miami welcomed us with open arms. We want to show Bitcoin to the whole world. We are taking the conference on the road to set the stage for Bitcoin in a new city. Nashville. Bitcoin 2024 is coming to Nashville in Tennessee, a city that is known as a music and freedom city. Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville from July 25th to 27th.
Plebs, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, then you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's a free and a paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts, Dylan LeClaire, Dr. Jeff Ross, and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com.
That's a deep topic. I don't know if you want to get into that now.
I mean, always. We don't have to. Up to you.
Sure. So my piece is called The Desert of the Real, Truth in Times of Mass Surveillance. And it touches on two different concepts of truth that exist in our time. One is the Greek understanding of truth, which is aletheia, which is the idea that truth is always something that is revealed to us, right? So this is kind of like how we do science, for example, right? So we keep finding out new things, and the more things we find out, the more truth we have about our world and our universe. And our second understanding of truth is called Veritas, which, funnily enough, is also the slogan of Harvard University. That's a Roman idea, and the idea of Veritas is the idea that truth is something that you can justify or that you can reason about. The problem with the latter understanding of truth, the Roman one, is that when you base your truth on something that you can reason, then you're basing it on something that must be subjective, right? And this is something that, for example, Nietzsche talked about a lot in his early writings, is that when you base your truth on something that is subjective, you must develop this need for power, because for your understanding of truth to actually be true, you need other people to believe it as well. And so what I basically wrote about was how this reflects, for example, in the case of Assange as well, who revealed truths to us, as in the first understanding of truth, as in aletheia. And yet a lot of the public narrative diverts to the other understanding of truth with this Veritas, which is he exposed state secrets and put people at risk of the military-industrial complex, which obviously is also true, right? It's a part of the truth. But then you begin neglecting everything that he has done, everything that has been revealed to us because of him. You just kind of start ignoring that, right? Because that's something that maybe you can't reason with your worldview or whatever. Yeah, and then I get into how we've come to such a place, which is also a kind of interesting story. It dates back to like the 70s and ideas of Jacques Derrida, who saw mass surveillance, so the idea of satellites, it was back then, as a way to assert authority over what people are thinking. And we saw this, for example, with the Cambridge Analytica scandal a couple of years back, where the Leave EU campaign just printed false statements on a huge bus. But most of the people believed these statements because they thought, well, you know, they're from the government and they're printed on a huge bus, so they must be true, right? Yeah, and that's what the article is about, of how mass surveillance is not only something that is dangerous because it infringes on our ability to have privacy, but also because it is actually a tool to undermine democracy, because you can actually, the more you know about a person, the more you can actually make them reason things that aren't necessarily true.
Wow, very cool. Yeah, great explanation. I believe we are posting it to the website tomorrow. I just want to get that right, but not mislead everybody. Very, very soon anyway. Very, very excited. It's a wonderful piece. There's also a great Assange quote in there from 2011. So, you know, similar time we're talking about here. That is, if wars can be started by lies, peace can be started by truth. Very nice classic Assange piece in there. Yeah, thanks, Lola. Appreciate it. It's a wonderful piece. Great writer. Highly recommend checking it out. Thank you for doing that for us in the general. Heidi, what's up? How are you this morning?
I'm good. So yeah, I loved her I loved your piece. I already mentioned that to her. And you know, you talked about it kind of being gatekeeping goes both ways. And you know, there's another quote he had, transparency for the powerful, privacy for the weak. And I don't think of myself as weak. And you know, I was just looking up a definition of weak, and it says likely to fall under pressure, stress, or strain, lacking resistance. And one of the other things Assange talks about is, you know, that resistance is encryption. Encryption is our resistance to this surveillance. That's what he thought is. And you talked about how technically astute he was about Bitcoin. He was a cryptographer, but he also, he was a committer to Postgres database. So he knew a lot of the different areas of technology already before Bitcoin even came along. But my article in the magazine, I had this quote: left to its own trajectory, within a few years, global civilization will be a postmodern surveillance dystopia from which escape for all but the most skilled individuals will be impossible. And so when we talk about the escape, that is, you know, using encryption, using privacy tools, having privacy by design versus just privacy by policy in our tools. So I was really about, you know, trying to think about this, gatekeeping your information, being careful who you share information with, you know, just basic security, but also privacy, and really thinking about that. And then I took some time to work on with Richard this PGP. It's not a full guide, but just kind of key commands to have people look further. And then how you store your PGP keys, like using the YubiKey. And then I think just yesterday, NoBS Bitcoin put out something about a new tool called MemeKey, where you can generate PGP key with a seed phrase, use a seed phrase. So you can easily back it up just like Bitcoiners are used to with hardware wallet seeds, et cetera. And so more and more tools are coming out that will help Bitcoiners, you know, use private communication mechanisms and secure their keys and remember their keys and not lose their keys. And I think this is really part of gatekeeping your privacy. You know, it goes both ways.
Yeah, definitely. A really, really fantastic piece. And yeah, I just think that the general idea of, yeah, like you know, we talk about so much of privacy within Bitcoin, and you know, it's like it doesn't matter how unbelievably private or perfect anonymity within the mint or whatever you're doing, you know, using the tool, you know, it doesn't matter how private your transaction is. If then, you know, you're taking a selfie and posting it on Twitter with the thing that you're buying, or you're posting the invoice, you know, there's so many ways you can, you know, basically ungatekeep the information keeping this, you know, this transaction or this communication or this business or whatever it is from being private, you know, by just releasing information. And then a lot of that, you know, is pretty obvious. You know, it's like, okay, if you don't want people to know what you look like or what your name is, don't post a picture of your face with, you know, an ID in the frame or whatever. It's like, sure. Like that's, some of that stuff is relatively obvious, I would hope. But it, I do think it gets into a little bit more of the nuance of, you know, the metadata really does rule everything around us. And there's huge amounts of availability of metadata that can be pulled when we use a lot of these communication tools that, you know, we all rely on. And it is sort of strange, you know, we really fall back on convenience time and time again at the great, great, great cost of, you know, future forward facing, you know, communication privacy or financial privacy or whatever. And so I really just think in general, the idea of the piece, you know, putting the ball back in our court, you know, that's something that I think is very important about kind of the general theme of the magazine, and maybe just kind of in general things we should be thinking about is, you know, what is our responsibility here? What are the things we can actually do? And the majority of the things we can control and we have domain over are kind of our private, or rather our personal interactions, you know, with others on the internet. And we can kind of, you know, if your anonymity is better, everyone's is better. And so there are little things that you can do, you know, every day to be better and kind of recreate some of the, or rather, you know, change some of the norms, the social norms that we all have in the way that we communicate online, the surveillance tech, basically in the form of social media platforms that we use. You know, there's so many things that we can do on a personal level to better handle our own information that will actually, you know, I think pretty tangibly help make the internet, and therefore I think the world, a much safer, better place. You know, it's ironic. It's like we want to build the public square. It's very important that we have the public square to be able to have things like informed consent and a free press and all that. We need the public square very much so. But also, you know, we need a way to have a personal private conversation and to be able to hold, you know, certain secrets on a personal level. If anyone has those tools, we all need those tools. So long-winded way to say, really appreciate the piece, really appreciate the sentiment. I think it's an important thing for a lot of us to internalize as we, I don't know, we continue to, you know, push back at kind of this grander, you know, surveillance state. So thanks again, Heidi. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
What's up, Joe? Good morning.
Hey, brother. Good morning.
What is going on? Thanks for joining us. This is, everyone knows Joe, but, you know, GM, fearless leader of the print magazine. Also had a phenomenal piece in the Gatekeepers issue, looking at the mining side of things, and designed this really beautiful hash price calculator with AB, our you know, kind of queen of print, the lead designer. Yeah, man. Any chance you want to kind of talk to us a little bit about that piece and, you know, kind of the general idea of what you were thinking and trying to give people some information before they sort of dive into the mining world?
Well, sure. Yeah. I know that, you know, hash price isn't exactly the main theme of the Gatekeepers issue, but we do try to cover, you know, many bases in each print magazine. And for me, just as a very small scale, smaller scale miner, the kind of like the one metric that miners talk about that maybe, you know, the plebs or just a generalist doesn't fully understand is hash price. And my goal of this piece was to really pull back the curtains and help someone understand, like, what is hash price and why is it important? If I was just going to summarize it, you know, for the audience here today, wrote a nice little piece in the magazine. It digs into what is hash price, and it essentially is how many US dollars you would get per day per terahash of mining. So it's generally measured by the cents. So I think today it's like 6.8 cents per terahash per day. So simple math, just for everyone listening. So like 100 terahash ASIC, like an S19, you know, has 100 terahash. So you multiply 6.8 times 100, and then that's how many dollars you get per day for that one ASIC. So really, the point of the piece, Mark, is to equip a reader with like understand the formulas that go into hash price, explaining why hash price is important. And probably like my most favorite contribution is the calculator. So Annabelle and I, we teamed up and we ran the numbers and we put together a physical pop out in the magazine that you, and for subscribers, we're including a little brass paper fastener. And you can actually put the two pieces together, they're circular, and they go over the top of each other. And you can rotate the top dial on top of the bottom one, depending on what the hash rate is for the whole network. And it'll tell you what the hash price is at any given price, between $10,000 and $100,000 per Bitcoin. So this is a cool thing. It was kind of like a first for us to do a pop out like this. And this magazine is really incredible. There's so many kind of goodies that we've snuck in. I don't want to steal any thunder, Mark. I'm going to keep talking. But of course, we have this beautiful collaboration with Proof of Paint. So we've included the one-off Julian Assange card that all subscribers get. We have addressed postcards that will go to Julian in his prison cell. So all you have to do is write the message and put postage on, and those postcards are good to go to Julian. And of course, this there's bookmarks included on those same pages that pop out, and then the hash price calculator. So we really like, I think that we set the bar, Mark, maybe too high. It's going to be hard to top this one. But we'll give it a college try here next quarter as well. Hope that's helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a lot of the Julian art in this is absolutely ridiculous. I think Proof of Paint did a phenomenal job with the Julian Joker, the back cover, and the insert. Obviously, I think the front cover is pretty wild. Really, really great photo. It's really sad. I think that's a big part of this as well. I think it's very fun to get, you know, to get kind of jazzed up on the applications of Bitcoin and like looking at how it actually worked in an adversarial environment. And, you know, just a bunch of, you know, there's a lot of beauty in this story, of course, but there's just a lot of sadness too. I mean, I really view Julian as an other. He's a human being. He's a father, husband, son, brother, and he's been very, very much so illegally prosecuted for being an active journalist, and has been really slandered and character attacked and legally attacked and financially attacked, you know, really for just being a really thoughtful person and understanding that, you know, a lot of people aren't willing to kind of take the plunge and take the sacrifice that could come from, you know, very, very boldly and proudly sharing and distributing information that is important for the people to see. Then he took a huge risk, and he has been attacked for it for such a long time. And it's incredibly, incredibly sad that we've really kind of normalized this. That's kind of one of my main takeaways from doing this, you know, is kind of balancing the like, okay, I don't want to just like commodify Julian here. That's fucked up. He's a real person. He's a human being. But like we need to shout and scream about this. You know, if any of us consider ourselves journalists or freedom fighters or you know, any of the things, crypto punks, you know, or cypher punks rather, you know, we if one of us is in jail, you know, if one of us isn't free, none of us are free. And so I think it's just a really important time. There's actually sort of political favor that is now kind of coming of, you know, to pardon Julian and to end this kind of this attack on free press. And I think it's one of the most important times ever for people to really, you know, scream and fight for Julian to be free. And not only that, but also to continue the work, continue talking about the things that he discovered, that he found, that he shared with us, that he risked so much, and he's already given up so many years of his life you know, just to speak the truth. And if we don't continue doing that, we don't speak the truth, we don't continue his work and his research and his, you know, novel ways of publishing and, you know, really attack this thing kind of head on. If we don't take inspiration from this to fight back in our own way, then it's like we've failed him twice. So really hope that, you know, kind of a fun, kind of weird rambling space. We covered a lot of things in this, you know, this kind of like hour here. But I really think that that's kind of the main takeaway is like, you know, we can't really be silent right now. It's too important. It's too dire, you know, and there's a lot of things that he, you know, I always think it's kind of funny in a weird way that it's like he gets credit for exposing war crimes, you know, in the Afghanistan war when it's like literally the whole thing was a war crime, you know, or like our invasion of Iraq. It's like, these are things that were done for completely illegitimate reasons that we now know were illegitimate. They probably were always illegitimate and they were used as reasons to, you know, do military occupation, you know, of another country. All the things that we're upset at, you know, other countries doing now, right? And we just did it. And then he is able to find data and information that proves that, you know, according to the gatekeeper's own laws, you know, that's kind of the interesting wrinkle here of collateral murder. It's like looking at the video in the U.S. own laws, that is a war crime. Like that is something that they can't do within their own matrix of their own ideal of how, you know, military action should be carried out. So he was able to catch them at their own game within their own rules. And that's why they're so upset. That's why they're so, I mean, he really, it's a very embarrassing thing. And they're kind of stuck where it's like, okay, well, you can change the rules whenever you want to be able to, you know, give reason to invade another country. You can bend those rules all the time. But within this very specific subset of fighting, you know, you violated this rule based on your own rules. And that's, yeah, it pissed them off to such an extreme degree because they have to kind of confront the bigger things that they're doing here because now it's in their own courts that, you know, they committed a war crime. But the whole thing was a war crime. And we know that. So, you know, we have to sort of do the Julian here and find the ways that using their own words and their own laws and their own rules, we can find them cheating and lying and within their own system. And then as well, taking the zoom out and looking at the much bigger coalition and this bigger conspiracy against, you know, kind of the freedom of the human race and looking at these ways where, okay, well, even within the rules, who gives a shit? They're just being bad people and doing bad things. And I think he's just such an incredibly smart person and someone we should really look up to and sort of emulate using these tools to push back. So I hope the gatekeepers issue, you know, is well read and appreciated. There's so much amazing contribution in there from so many amazing people. And there's a lot of secrets and a lot of things that we shoved in there that I hope you guys find to carry on your own journey of figuring out what the hell is going on and ways to fight back. So I really appreciate everyone, you know, subscribing and keeping this print magazine alive. We really appreciate that. We take it very seriously and yeah, we really appreciate any opportunity we can to, you know, get together and talk about it. So thankful for you guys all joining us this morning. I know Heidi's got her hand. We can let everyone kind of give their last thoughts and then we'll probably sign off at the top of the hour.
Apologies if you already mentioned this, but did you mention the recent appeal failure against extradition? And I know you are encouraging people to speak up, but the issue is incredibly good timing in that it's coming out and that appeal is just lost. And, you know, it just raises awareness, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that it was Friday or Thursday, actually, maybe even a little bit earlier. But yeah, it looks like it was the 6th of June. Assange's application to appeal extradition to the United States, where he's facing criminal charges under the Espionage Act, they were denied. None of the four grounds of appeal raises any properly arguable point, according to Mr. Justice Swift, the high court judge there. And they also denied Assange's permission to appeal and challenge the dismissal of other parts of his case during a ruling by District Judge Vanessa Barrick Tissier in January 2021. After revising 8 proposed grounds of appeal, the judge argued he did not consider the proposed appeals raised any properly arguable case. The 51-year-old is wanted by U.S. authorities on 18 criminal accounts after WikiLeaks, the organization he founded, published thousands of classified documents and diplomatic cables in 2010 and 2011. A London court issued a formal extradition order to send the Australian to the U.S. in April last year. It was rubber-stamped by the U.K. government 2 months later. The Home Office stressed at the time that the U.K. courts have not found his extradition to be incompatible with his human rights. Unbelievable. That was a CNN right there, our favorite. Great point, Heidi. Thank you so much for bringing that up. That's true. Like, this is also another wrinkle here is, like, this is still a very live, ongoing thing. Assange has kind of been on the Mount Rushmore of cyberpunks for a long time. A lot of this kind of seems like ancient history. We're talking about something that happened 12 years ago today. But also, like, this is absolutely still going on. And we're hearing implications about his case. You know, we're finding out things, you know, as recently as last week. So definitely support Stella and Gabriel Shipton and a lot of the people that have been kind of waving the flag and, you know, pushing this for so long. And they really deserve to have their brother and their husband and their father free. And yeah, so, you know, again, I did say earlier, it was nice to see that there is a little bit of political movement and popularity kind of coming to the surface about letting Julian free. But, you know, here we are, you know, a week off from, you know, him being denied this appeal. So yeah, dark shit, unfortunately. That's a bummer. But thank you so much for bringing that up. I'm glad that we did mention that. Lola, anything you want to say on the way out as we wrap up the morning here?
No, I think just thank you for making this magazine. I think that it's really important.
Well, thank you. Thank you for making this magazine. You too, Heidi, everyone else. It's meaningless without readers, without people talking about it. I really appreciate the opportunity. As always, DMs and such always open. So please let us know if there's anything you'd like to see. And, you know, we'll do our best to accommodate it. Yeah, thanks so much, Chris. I don't know if you have anything you want to say before we sign off. Otherwise, yeah, have a beautiful morning. Free Assange now. Keep screaming. Keep reading. Go check out the keys, the WikiLeaks addresses. There's some things on the front cover. Go look up those things. Go find what those keys are for. And keep fighting.
Yeah, no, thanks, Mark. Thanks, Lola. Thanks, Heidi, and everyone that participated. I guess last thing on my end, the multimedia team, the last of the videos from the conference will be uploaded. So you can view all of Bitcoin 2023 up on our YouTube, Rumble. Yeah, so really excited to have those all up and done. And thanks so much for participating. We hope everyone gets their copy of the Gatekeeper issue. And then we hope to see everyone in Bitcoin Amsterdam and Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville. Have a good one, everyone. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Miami, for the last 3 years in this amazing city. The whole world shut down. But Miami welcomed us with open arms. We want to show Bitcoin to the whole world. We are taking the conference on the road to set the stage for Bitcoin in a new city. Nashville. Bitcoin 2024 is coming to Nashville in Tennessee. A city that is known as a music and freedom city. Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville from July 25th to 27th.
Plebs, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, then you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's a free and a paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire, Dr. Jeff Ross, and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com.